President Trump's national security team is finally coming together after yesterday's announcement that Army Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster will be the national security advisor. And even people who have been critical of Trump are giving the team high marks. Joining us now is retired Admiral James Stavridis, Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Admiral Stavridis, welcome back to Here and Now.
Always great to be on with you, Jeremy.
And you say that McMaster is a terrific pick. Why is that?
I'll give you three reasons. One is he has deep, deep operational experience. Silver Star winner, that's the number three combat decoration you can achieve in the United States. Number two, he's an intellectual with very few peers. PhD from UNC Chapel Hill, published a groundbreaking book, Dereliction of Duty. Reason number three is he's a creative thinker. He knows how to think his way out of a box. He worked for me in Afghanistan for a year. I put him on the toughest problem I had, which was corruption in the Afghan military, and he was superb. He's a wonderful pick.
What about his worldview? What can you tell us about that?
He is someone who believes in American exceptionalism. He believes in operating from a position of strength, but also understands that military power is not always the answer. In Iraq, when he was there as a colonel in command of a brigade up north in a place called Tal Afar, he was the first commander on the ground to truly effectively use soft power, counterinsurgency, working with the population. He was remarkable at his ability to balance both hard and soft power. And thirdly, he's a believer in the value system of the United States.
So what about this team that has developed now? You've got him, you've got retired Marine Generals James Mattis as Secretary of Defense and John Kelly as Director of Homeland Security. A lot of military men.
True. However, knowing all three of them, I would tell your listeners, these are not cliche military folks like Jack Nicholson screaming at the end of A Few Good Men. These are deeply well-read, historically grounded, thoughtful individuals who understand a lot more than just how to make a bullet land in the middle of the target set. So I think this is an all-star team, and I'm going to throw in there Rex Tillerson over at Secretary of State, who brings global knowledge, huge connections, and experience running a big organization. I don't think we have seen a better national security team person for person in a long time.
Do you believe that these men will be able to disagree with the president?
I think they'll be able to disagree with him. The question is, will the president then follow their advice after they disagree with him? And I think the jury's out on that. Frankly, we've seen already a series of back and forths on some pretty key foreign policy issues. One China policy kind of went to a two China policy. Now it seems back to a one China policy. Over in the Middle East, we had a two state solution, went to a one state solution. Seems kind of somewhere in the middle right now. Russia, we can't decide whether we're concerned about Vladimir Putin or we want to get very, very close to the Russian Federation. So I'm hopeful that these four individuals will provide some coherency of vision. And the $64,000 question, Jeremy, is will the president listen and follow it? I hope so.
Well, and then just yesterday we had General Mattis say we're not in Iraq to take the oil, which is exactly the opposite of what President Trump said just a month ago. So are we supposed to listen to the president or the Secretary of Defense on that?
I think what we should do is not necessarily listen, but watch what the administration actually does. Another example of this was during the campaign, candidate Trump talked about using waterboarding and using torture. General Mattis walked four square away from that in his confirmation hearings. We're not using those tools today. So I think there can be some disagreement and daylight between principals in a government. What you want to do is watch what the administration actually does. And again, we'll know so much more in 6 months about which way this breaks. But boy, that's a good team that will confront the president, and they will speak truth to power.
So, Admiral Stavridis, we've got that team that you are very happy with. And then you've also got Steve Bannon, the president's top political advisor on the National Security Council. Square that for us. What do you think about that?
Well, on the tactical level, it's a mistake for Steve Bannon to be on the National Security Council's Principles Committee. It injects a political voice into what ought to be a rational, fact-based discussion of our international security set. So putting a political operative in that is simply a mistake. Now, every president is entitled to have close advisors of varying backgrounds, and I have no problem with the president seeking and casting a wide net to get advice. But to mix those two together, the political and the national and international security, is a mistake. I would not be surprised to see Steve Bannon's participation in the Principles Committee diminish over time. Again, as a result, I think, of the combined throw weight of the other key individuals we've talked about.
That's retired Admiral James Stavridis, now Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts. Admiral Stavridis, thanks as always.
What a pleasure, Jeremy.
Well, the Department of Homeland Security today is unveiling new policies aimed at greatly expanding the number of immigrants illegally in the U.S. who are detained and deported. The guidelines spell out how the DHS and other federal agencies will implement two executive orders that President Trump signed last month on border security and enforcement of immigration laws. Joining us now is NPR's Joel Rose, who's been looking at the guidelines. Joel, who's been targeted for removal under these new guidelines?
Well, this is a big shift from the previous administration. Under the Obama administration, immigrants who are convicted of serious crimes were the priority for removal. But these new rules broaden out those priorities quite a bit. Border Patrol agents and customs officials have been directed in these rules to remove anyone who's convicted of a crime that could be using fraudulent documents to work. Agents are also instructed to go after unauthorized immigrants who may have committed a crime but not even been charged or have, quote, abused any program related to the receipt of public benefits, unquote. And indeed, anyone an immigration officer deems a risk to public safety or national security could now be a priority for removal. So the category has gotten a lot broader under these new rules.
And this big shift also includes so-called expedited removal for anyone who can't prove they've been living here in the U.S. continuously for 2 years. Explain more what that means.
Well, expedited removal is pretty much what it sounds like. It means that a migrant does not get to go before an immigration judge and can simply be deported. Under the Obama administration, expedited removal was used only within about 100 miles of the border for people who had been in the country for less than 14 days. Now it will include people who've been in the country for up to 2 years and could be located anywhere in the country. Civil rights advocates are worried about this. They say it'll deprive many migrants of a chance to make their case for asylum or to show that they have relatives living in the U.S. or for some other reason deserve relief from expedited deportation.
Joel, the new policies would not affect the program called DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the people who were brought here illegally as children. Why no changes there?
Right. Well, these rules explicitly do not include DACA. These are the so-called dreamers, the young people who were brought to the country illegally as children. President Trump said during the campaign that he would end DACA, but since then he has softened his stance and has said that this is a very difficult decision, what to do with these kids. And at least for now, it appears that the dreamers have gotten a reprieve in these rules.
Joel, talk a little bit about the policies that President Trump has criticized as catch and release, where immigrants who are detained are given court dates, sometimes years in the future. Do these guidelines address or change that at all?
I think they're explicitly intended to. I mean, DHS officials said today on a background call with reporters that these rules are supposed to end this policy of catch and release on the southern border, which we should say is not the official policy of the U.S. border, but it's what critics have been saying for years is what happens, as you describe. People arrive at the border, they're detained, they're given a court date sometime in the future, and they sometimes abscond before that court date. But civil liberties advocates worry that if you just deport everyone, you're going to be catching up a lot of migrants who do have some due process rights or asylum seekers or others who really would have a legitimate claim to get in. And they're worried that those people will just be turned away.
Joel, a federal official in a briefing today said, look, we don't want to create a sense of panic here. But what's the reaction so far to these new rules out there?
Well, I talked to some immigration rights activists on a conference call last week when an earlier draft version of these rules had leaked to the public. And it was an earlier draft, but a lot of the points were the same. And those immigration rights activists think that this, in fact, is intended to cause panic. At least that's their contention, that this is an intentional campaign to instill panic throughout the immigrant community and throughout the larger community. And I think the fear is that anybody could be a deportation priority under these rules, that they're so broad. And so immigrant lawyers for immigrants or immigration lawyers see this as a blueprint for mass deportation. Now, DHS officials said today on the background call that that's not what this is. This is not a mass deportation blueprint and that there is no reason for panic in immigrant communities. But I think, you know, those communities will look at these rules and may not be particularly comforted.
But there's a lot of anxiety and stress throughout the country on these new guidelines.
That's right.
And briefly, Joel, how are federal agencies going to get this done? Very briefly.
Well, it's going to take a lot of resources. The DHS officials talk – or the new rules talk about a joint plan with the Department of Justice to surge more immigration judges and asylum officers to the border, as well as hiring 10,000 new custom enforcement agents and 5,000 Border Patrol agents.
NPR's Joel Rose. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Vice President Mike Pence is back in Washington after a trip to Europe to try to reassure nervous allies there about foreign policy in the Trump administration. There's also concern in China about what the future holds as the new administration takes over. John Pomfret has long reported on and studied the relationship between the U.S. and China. His new book is The Beautiful Country and the Middle Kingdom, America and China, 1776 to the present. John, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've said this relationship between the U.S. and China is really too important to fail. Tell us why.
Well, for one, the trading relationship is absolutely enormous. China has off and on been our biggest trading partner over the course of the last 5 years. And China and American companies are basically integrated in the global supply chain for all things from Apple iPhones to Dell computers to a variety of products to airplanes, etc. And so just from the trading aspect, it's a hugely important relationship. And then you look at climate change. The two countries are working very closely together, at least they were, trying to deal with climate change. And then also on security issues. I mean, probably the most dangerous place in the world right now would be considered North Korea. And how and if the United States and China can work together to tamp down that place as a threat, it would be enormously consequential, not just for America and China, but for all of Northeast Asia as well.
Trade, security, climate change, those are big.
Those are huge. And counterterrorism as well. Both countries clearly have a shared interest in tamping down counterterrorism.
Right after the inauguration, President Trump called the president of Taiwan. That angered Beijing. Since then, has reversed himself and said he backs the one China policy. What's the current thinking in Beijing about President Trump?
So during the campaign, the Chinese seemed to be very supportive of Trump, partially because they really didn't like Secretary of State Hillary Clinton at all. They had a sense that Trump would be transactional in his relationship with China, that they could do business with a businessman. But then on the one China issue, he began to question whether the United States had to continue its policy of basically acknowledging that China wants Taiwan back, but not acknowledging that Taiwan really belongs to China. And so in taking the phone call from the president, Tsai Ing-wen, he basically drew from the Chinese perspective, he was questioning sort of the whole basis of the relationship between the United States and China over the last almost five decades. And now that he's walked that back, it seems that to a certain extent, folks in Beijing are a little more calm about the relationship, but still they look at Trump as a highly unpredictable potential partner with China. They don't know what he's going to do next. And actually, from Trump's perspective, he's kind of doing – he seems to be doing that a bit on purpose. But we're still really waiting for the Trump administration to tell us what its China policy is. Right now, we're at this kind of moment where, you know, because Trump had threatened effectively a trade war with China – threatened to slap 45% tariffs on all Chinese goods, but it doesn't now seem he doesn't seem to be wanting to do that anymore. So exactly how he's going to approach China, I think, still is a huge open question, both for Americans who are interested in the subject, but also for the Chinese.
Business interests and diplomacy want a certain level of stability and predictability, and he's unpredictable, and that unnerves Beijing.
Yeah, exactly. Beijing is clearly unnerved. Now, that he walked back the one China policy was portrayed in some circles in the United States as sort of a sign of his weakness. But I think that was sort of, from my perspective, that was the basis from which the relationship can now proceed. Because if you don't accept the one China policy, which is actually not that onerous for the United States to accept, the Chinese won't do business with you at all. And they also are in positions to do a lot of troubling things to the United States or to America's potential competitors around the world. For example, they could not carry out UN sanctions on North Korea, or they could break sanctions with Iran, or they could resume missile sales to Syria and to Iran. So the Chinese have a potential of being – of misbehaving. Hmm. And American administrations have clearly learned lessons about that.
John, we should explain the one China policy. China sees Taiwan as a renegade province. Explain the one China policy to us.
So from the U.S. perspective, saying that they agree to the one China policy means basically the United States acknowledges that China wants Taiwan back. But the United States does not acknowledge that Taiwan actually belongs to the People's Republic of China. That's not the U.S. policy, basically. We just sort of acknowledge that, yeah, that's you want that back, we get it, but that's it. And so from that perspective, it's not that onerous for American presidents to embrace that policy.
Last time we talked, you said you do not think there will be a trade war between the U.S. and China. Do you still think that, and why?
Every president since Richard Nixon has run on a platform of getting tough with China, except for Obama. So Carter did it. Clinton did it. George W. Bush did it. And so I think Trump falls into that category of saying, I'm going to be tough on China. But once he enters office, the reality of this massively complex, very important relationship sets in. And the China trade relationship, if you, for example, begin to sanction all these Chinese imports to the United States, you definitely harm China, but you also harm hugely Western companies all over the world, including American companies. I mean, 50% of China's exports to the United States are made by foreign companies in China. And of those exports, if it's a high-tech export, it's 70%. And so you are hurting, definitely hurting Chinese, but you're also hurting Western companies and American companies as well. And so slapping a broad tariff just on Chinese products, I don't think is going to go. And you clearly see the Trump administration pivoting away from that and embracing more broadly a border tax on all imports to the United States. But we don't even know if that's going to happen, again, because the potential economic fallout could be so significant.
It's an economic relationship, again, too big to fail.
Exactly. I think we're witnessing very publicly and sometimes embarrassingly the education of Donald Trump on China. And you see people around him pushing him in potentially a more rational direction towards dealing with China. But I also have to acknowledge that I think he embraced an essential truth about our relationship with China. And it's that for the last 10 years, perhaps more, it's been unbalanced. And that the Chinese have really played the United States. And I think Trump identifying that is something we have to give him credit for. The question is, what type of strategy is he going to come up with that might help the United States right the balance of the relationship? And I think that's the huge challenge.
It's a bit of on-the-job training, but give him credit for taking a different new approach to China.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about North Korea. China just suspended imports of coal from North Korea. Did China take that step in response to North Korea's recent missile test?
So it's clear that in Chinese society, for example, everybody basically thinks North Korea is a joke, a very scary joke, but a joke. I mean, people travel to North Korea from China to kind of look at it as like, this is what we were like. This is what China was like when it was poor and really communist. They talk about Kim Jong-un. They call him Jin Sampang. So that means Kim number three fatty. And so on a societal level, they look down their noses at the North Koreans. But from a geopolitical standpoint, they kind of look at North Korea as their East Germany. And they think if it collapses, well, we're going to be next, or we could be next. You know, you have the peninsula united under a pro-American South Korean, well, Korean government. What do you do with the 30,000 American troops there, et cetera? So it's a cascading series of bad potential events should that regime collapse. So they support it. And now, though, they're clearly unhappy with Kim Jong-un's continued missile tests and nuclear tests, and they want that to stop. At the same time, they're not willing to risk the collapse of the regime. So they're stuck in a way. And so this latest coal import ban is clearly designed to cut into the foreign exchange earnings of the North Korean regime in order to slow down, perhaps, their military programs. But we have to see whether, one, it's actually carried out, and two, if there's another, the other shoe's going to drop, which would mean squeezing North Korea even more. And one of the areas they could do would be in cutting its China's oil exports to North Korea. And there are other areas as well in terms of blocking a whole array of Chinese companies which have been helping North Korea break the sanctions for years. And so this is a good first step, but there's a lot more that China can do. China says it has no influence over North Korea, and that's just not true. It really controls the access, the trade access, and the money flows into North Korea as well.
And John, what are we to make of North Korea's role and potentially Kim Jong-un's role in the bizarre assassination of his half-brother in Malaysia? What motivation does he have to do that if he did?
So it's clear that Kim Jong-un viewed his brother, half-brother, as a potential political rival. Mm. And so being in a political dynasty, he just made the decision to rub him out. And he got him in a place where he was less protected than if he was in Macau or in China, because there the Chinese were giving him bodyguards.
John Pomfret, his latest book is The Beautiful Country in the Middle Kingdom, America and China, 1776 to the present. John, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
The storm systems that have pelted California with rain, causing flooding, evacuations, mudslides, and stress, are finally weakening. But scattered showers are predicted to continue through the day. A levee break along the San Joaquin River near Manteca put about 500 people under an evacuation order with a flash flood warning for today. Crews temporarily halted the break last night. The small town of Maxwell in Colusa County started dealing with its flood at 2 a.m. on Saturday when homes and businesses were inundated and many of the town's 1,100 residents fled for higher ground. Don Bransford is a rice farmer in Colusa, about 10 miles east of Maxwell. He joins us on the line. Don, how are you and your farm holding up?
We're doing okay. We have a fair amount of rice ground, and it is actually all underwater, which is not harmful at this time of the year. But the big issue would be the orchard, the permanent crops. And there are almonds that are blooming right now. They need sun and warmth. And with this rain, that will definitely impact the crop. There are prunes that are yet to bloom. And then the other issue we have is seepage. There's a tremendous amount of seepage from the river, and it looks like the river's going to stay up for some time, and that seepage is not good for the roots on the walnuts, the almonds, and prunes. But it's made it very difficult in terms of roots in and out of our little community. We're about 5,000 people, and we're located right on the Sacramento River. Actually, the levee butts up to town, and so we have a wall of water that's contained by the levees of the Sacramento River. Now we have two routes out of town, one to the north and one to the east. Our western roads are closed due to flood water, and it's from creeks coming out of the mountains. So if you were to fly over us, you would see lots and lots of water completely surrounding the community.
And there's some damage so far. Are things looking a little better today weather-wise? Are the waters starting to subside?
It's going to take a couple days, and then we'll probably see noticeable changes. Once the higher flows out of the foothills slows down, then we should see things getting back to somewhat normalcy.
Don, the long-term forecast is for some more rain this coming weekend. Are people taking precautions now? We saw photos of people putting up sandbags in front of their homes and businesses.
Atmospheric rivers are the ones where we get a sustained period of rain that are causing the problems. If we just get showers over the weekend, I don't think that's going to cause any additional problems, because we'll have a break of a few days before the next storm comes in.
still a bit of unease. You're waiting to see what the weather does and how much damage there is on the ground with these permanent crops.
Yes, the greatest unease is Colusa's is next to the river, and the river is running extremely high. It's below flood stage. They have to get the water out of Shasta because Shasta is filling, and then we have all these side creeks that eventually flow into the Sacramento River, and so there's a lot of water to drain out of the Northern California Valley, and so people are quite anxious when you go up and take a look at how high that river is. And the same thing on the Feather. They're having to run the Feather high to maintain Lake Oroville at a safe level. We haven't seen this in almost 20 years. So for some people, it's a new experience, and it's quite frightening.
Don, hang in there, and good luck.
All right. Thank you.
Don Bransford is a rice farmer near Maxwell, California, in Colusa County, about 65 miles northwest of Sacramento and near the Sacramento River.
Utilities that own the largest coal-powered plant in the western United States have agreed to shut it down 25 years ahead of schedule. The Navajo Generating Station in northern Arizona has powered homes in major western cities like L.A., Las Vegas, and Phoenix for decades, but its owners say cheap natural gas is more cost-effective than burning coal. Closing the plant will be a major blow to the economy of the already impoverished Navajo Nation, which leases the land to the utilities. Russell Begay is president of the Navajo Nation. He joins us now. President Begay, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, it's great to be on your show. Thank you.
And were you surprised by this decision to close the plant?
Yes, because we've been working diligently for the last couple of years, especially the last year, to extend the contract, the new agreement, up to 24-4. We've met every obstacle that they posed to us, including the environmental issues, including the cost of coal. And then at the end, they threw in this whole new ranch of saying, we decided to close the plant after all.
And how big of a blow is it to your people? Because we should say the Navajo Nation is very poor. 43% of the population lives in poverty. And this plant and the coal mine that supplies it employs more than 750 people.
That's correct, because the coal mine is the sole supplier to the power plant. So the Kayenta mine, which is on Navajo, it's Navajo coal. Our people work in there. They transport the coal over to the power plant. So both the miners and the people that work at the plant will be impacted. So over 1,000 jobs will be lost because of this. And, of course, the revenue, both coupled with the mine and the power plant together, is right about 40%. And so to lose that kind of revenue is going to devastate us. Let me tell you, our Hopi neighbors, the Hopi Nation, they will even be hit even harder because 85% of their revenue comes from both the coal and from the operation at the power plant. So both of our nation will be hit very hard.
And how are you going to make up that gap? Where are you going to find that money now if you don't have the plant?
Well, I tell you, if they had given us at least 5 to 10 years to prepare for this, yeah, we would have prepared for that. We would have made some adjustments. We would have made some transition. I mean, we're talking about just days ago, we were told that the plant was going to close in 2019.
And one of the things that you've been doing is asking President Trump, who has promised to keep coal jobs alive, to help you out. What exactly are you asking the administration for?
Well, first of all, basically to say, you know, President Trump, you said you were going to bring coal back, and that's what you promised. And so we're expecting you to come alongside Navajo Nation. This is the first test. This is the first opportunity to really make a strong statement to the coal industry, to the power plants out there, to say, I, as president, made this statement, and I'm going to stand behind this. However way it's done, whether it's through the exemption, federal tax exemption will be huge. And also some subsidies will be important. And then also for the president to go out to companies that he knows and have them become part owners of the power plant and let the others leave if they want to leave.
But why do you think that new owners would look at the situation differently than the current owners who say it's not cost effective to burn coal anymore?
Well, they're not losing money. that we know. They're not making as much money as they say if they move over to natural gas. So they're not losing money. Plus, it has a huge impact in terms of the whole economy in the region. There are surrounding towns like the city of Page, Flagstaff, Tucson, Phoenix. And this is the time for President Trump to say, I'm going to bring my partners together. We're going to back up this plant. We're going to invest in this. And we're going to keep the revenue flowing. We're going to make sure that the whole region is not negatively impacted. That's what we expect him to do.
Well, what about the idea of converting it to a natural gas plant? Because as you said, they can make more money with natural gas right now than with coal.
Well, based on our estimation, we're talking about 3 years before the natural gas will spike, and it will be even with how much it costs to run the plant using coal. Plus also the conversion is going to take time, it's going to be costly. And so it's better to build a new plant someplace else on Navajo Nation. And that's one of the things we're saying is that if we have time, we can build a natural gas generator over on the New Mexico site along some of the big power lines. And we would ask the owners of the power plant, you took billions from us. You mined our coal. You built a generator. Don't just hang us dry. We've got $4.3 million a year, which is pennies that we got for the last 50 years, and when we should have been making at least $20 to $30 million a year from the plant. But back then, when the lease was signed, we just didn't make the adjustment for inflation increases and other things like that. So we really were shortchanged with this whole deal. And so they make their million or billions and not come back and help us replace the revenue that we're going to lose.
Well, what about the environmental issues? The EPA said that this plant is the third most polluting coal plant in the country as of 2014. It's blamed for the smog that's visible at the nearby Grand Canyon. Isn't closing this down going to be good for the health of your people in a way?
Yes, both the Four Corners Power Plant, which is over on the New Mexico site on Navajo land, and then this plant, which is by Page, they're shutting down generators to get down to where EPA said you have to be. And so they're meeting the standards by shutting down and by operating less. And so, yes, it was polluting, especially worse back 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And that really devastated our health, our land, our water.
So did you try as a result of that to move to wind and solar and change your economy decades ago, or did you not do that?
Well, we're the first Indian nation to develop a solar power plant, a solar farm. We're the first one. We're moving into the wind industry. The thing with these two is that you got to have customers. You got to have somebody that's going to buy it from you. And so there's some challenges there. The revenue that we make out of the other plant on the New Mexico site is that we're taking a percentage of the revenue and investing in solar and wind. And we want to do this aggressively. And so we were counting on the revenue that we were going to make from 2019 on to 2024 to make this transition. And so those are monies that we were depending on, looking to move us aggressively into renewable energy and away from coal.
One more question, President Begay. How do you feel Native Americans are being treated generally by this new administration? How does it compare to President Obama?
Well, you know, President Obama has been a friend to Native Americans. And one thing that President Obama has done is that he's opened the door for tribal leaders to advise and to be at the table, decision-making table, in almost all of the federal agencies. That's unprecedented. That's never happened before. And in the White House Council on Indian Affairs, that has never happened before. And so all of those has really opened up the doors for us to understand how funding works. We've been able to generate more appropriation for our programs, for our people. And President Trump is just now coming in, but we are determined to really push this new president to say, if you're talking about self-reliance, self-dependency, and we are ready to assume our own future, our own destiny. For example, we want full control over all of our natural resources. Today, we don't have authority over our natural resources. That means coal and oil and any mineral that's in the ground. And we don't get any compensation for that because we're told you don't own it. That belongs to the federal government. And we're going to see how far we can push this president, and that's what we've done with every president. Tell you, we survived every president since George Washington, and we're going to survive this one, and we're going to do our best to be able to take advantage of their policies, their philosophies, and see if they really mean what they say.
That's Navajo Nation President Russell Begay. President Begay, thank you.
Good to be on your show. Thank you.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has a vision for the future of the world, and, big surprise, Facebook is a key factor. Last week, Zuckerberg published a nearly 6,000-word politically charged manifesto on a range of issues, from using Facebook to create stronger offline communities to using artificial intelligence to weed out what he called sensationalism or fake news. For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kara Swisher is executive editor of Recode and host of the Recode Decode podcast. She interviewed Zuckerberg about his essay and is generally the big boss at Recode. Hi, Kara.
Hi, generally. So, not every day.
Well, start with your conversation with Zuckerberg. What did he say he was aiming to do with this manifesto?
Well, let's begin by saying Mark Zuckerberg is probably the most earnest CEO in Silicon Valley. And so he was really quite genuine in doing this. I mean, a lot of people could look at this cynically, you know, and say Facebook's solution for world problems is more Facebook, which it is, which is what he actually did say in this essay. But I think he really cares about these issues, and they've been weighing on his mind, especially in this election when a lot of people have been attacking Facebook, sometimes very deservedly, for the proliferation of fake news and its impact on news and the way people get that news, and depending on how the quality of it. He's been very worried about it and how the platform's being used.
And he wants to use artificial intelligence to combat that. Explain.
Among other things. He wants people to be nicer, but that's like a big ask for the human race. I think what he's talking about is using artificial intelligence to figure out how to get people which one of these pieces of information is false and which is not. And that's a difficult thing because some things are in a gray area, as he's talked about before, and other things, it depends on your opinion. Some things are just true facts, of course, even though in this day and age people pretend they're not. There are such things as that. And so what he's trying to do is figure out how you can see patterns, how you can see how people read things. Often when people share headlines of articles they don't read, they're false, for example. They have a lot of signals. And when people read them and share them more than twice, there's all kinds of different ways to look at that. And, you know, it's not just that, not just news, but he was very troubled by a suicide that was live streamed on Facebook recently. It was very disturbing to him. And he said there's maybe signals to stop this before it happens or to stop it in mid, you know, crisis, whatever the crisis may be. But he also said you could use this artificial intelligence to track terrorists too. So that's a little more troubling, of course, is both those things, even though we want to prevent suicides, should you be really spying on people in their homes? Should you be able to track them such a way? Should you be able to use Facebook as a government agency, really, because that's what government agencies do, and that's already controversial when the government's doing it.
He specifically talked to you about globalization. What did he say? What was that about?
Well, he was trying hard not to say the word Trump, and there's no word Trump in any of it. But I think the issue is that when Facebook started, he said it was among the first lines in this essay, is that sharing globally didn't used to be controversial. Globalization did not used to be controversial. And so he was – I think he's troubled by the idea that there's an open question that we should be as global as we are. And of course, Facebook is predicated on a global platform. And so it's of concern to him that it's become controversial.
He is sort of apologetic in this manifesto, or it seems like there's something behind that. Yeah, tell us more about that.
Well, you know, he's more apologetic than most Silicon Valley people who are just arrogant about what they do. They don't see the consequences. I think this is the first moment I've seen from him where he's taken consequences. You know, the consequences of the massive Facebook platform might not be as good as he envisioned. And maybe there's some things they could tweak. And so this was more a letter to his employees, which he said several times, to talk about the future of Facebook. And I think one of the things he's worried about is filter bubbles, is that Facebook was built around friends and family. And so what you tend to do are people that are like you. And so what you tend to do is go off into your little corners, and then there's no discussion or debate or, an open discussion of ideas. And so one of the things he wants to push is that Facebook doesn't just bring you to people you know, but people you don't know and people that you might disagree with. And it also helps foment offline communities, that you can use tools on Facebook to build stronger offline communities. He believes that the decline of offline communities is one of the reasons our society has become so fractured.
Kara, Mark Zuckerberg, unlike some of his colleagues in Silicon Valley, is somebody who doesn't do a lot of interviews. It's pretty rare that you got to speak with him.
Yeah.
And maybe even more rare that he put out this manifesto, this 6,000-word manifesto.
Writes a lot. He does write a lot. Okay. He's always on Facebook yammering about something.
What do you think about the fact that he did this and is willing to talk about it, wants to talk so much about this right now?
Well, I guess, someone joked that it was the thesis at Harvard that he never completed because he never completed Harvard, essentially, and he just wanted to write it. I did say he could use a little editing, Mark. Like, he just, like, it was like type, 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 type.
You said that to Mark Zuckerberg?
Sure. Why not? I mean, he did do it himself, apparently. That's what he says. And I think he did. It really does read like someone didn't have enough editing going on. And, of course, nobody wants to challenge Mark, but it definitely could have used a little judicious editing. It's long, and it's a rumination, and I think there's a lot of things going on in it at the same time. Someone did a 5-sentence version of it online. They put it into a computer and it came out just like 300 words, which was very funny. Huh. I sent it to him. I thought it was funny.
And that's Kara Swisher, executive editor of Recode. We'll link you to more about her interview with Mark Zuckerberg at hereandnow.org. Kara, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.